Monica, number one.
Mr. Chair, item number one is from the Secretary of State. It is requesting an allocation from the E-Fund of $893,779 to meet the matching requirements for the Help America Vote Act. It's the next installment payment, the Federal Fiscal Year 2004 appropriation of almost $17.9 million. And unfortunately, maybe the Secretary is arriving.
We're recommending we defer this because we don't have enough information.
Yes, okay. Mr. Chair, we are opposed recommending that this request be deferred because there are some outstanding issues that need clarification from the Election Assistance Commission on what can be used for matching funds. We have assumed that federal guidelines that have been used in the past, the Secretary of State has followed those in collecting staff time and some of the purchases that they have made. We just don't have final confirmation that those will be accepted, nor interest earnings on the account, whether those will be accepted. Given the Secretary of State's expenditure pattern, they're not anticipating needing the $17.9 million until probably fall of 2005.
Okay, so the recommendation is deferral. Is any other, any
we
other discussion?
We have the Secretary here. Maybe we could find out just where he is on the whole plan.
I knew you were going to drag this out. Bill?
If he hadn't come, I wouldn't say.
You'll have plenty of chances to talk.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, thank you very much. For the record, Bill Bradbury, Secretary of State. There is no damage to the ongoing election programs from this deferral because we would not anticipate spending the money that's coming until the next biennium. The only thing I need to say on the record is that the federal government will earn interest on this money instead of the state government. We are, by not getting this money, we're not earning about $235,000. That's all. I just need to, you need to all be aware of that. It sits at the federal treasury instead
of. So by not spending $900, we lose $200.
That's right. You got it. That's a hard one to calculate, Mr. Chair.
Boy, I love coming to this place. Okay. So any other?
Just a question about the
Miller.
Deferral, which I will certainly support, about the way in which this program is being carried out.
We're not carrying it out.
The Assistance with Voter Act?
Oh, okay.
I think we are.
Oh, okay.
And the question that I have involves a mailing that my daughter received entitled Dear New Voter. You're probably familiar with that. But I guess one of the reasons I was somewhat on alert is shortly before that I received a mailing that's a very nice piece. It says, no matter where you live, Congresswoman Darlene Hooley is working for you. This, although it's a fabulous campaign piece, is something I paid for because it was mailed at taxpayer expense at the federal level out of her office. So shortly thereafter, I received this Dear New Voter, or my daughter did. And a question is, I wonder, do you, how many other supposed new voters received this mailing?
Mr. Chair, it'd be okay to have the elections director answer that specific question.
Sir, if we're looking for an answer, I think we ought to.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, it's my understanding that about 50,000 young, about to become voters, received that letter.
Well, I know she was pleased because she's a registered voter in a different state. I'm wondering where you got the list of the 50,000 people.
It's my understanding that the list was obtained from the Department of Motor Vehicles.
And a list of all Oregonians about to turning 18? Or
would be turning 18 shortly before Election Day.
And do you recall how much the list cost?
I think that we were, the list itself, I'm not aware of that because I wasn't directly involved in this project, but the overall cost of the mailing was in somewhere in the neighborhood of $18,000, which included all costs.
My understanding is $17,000 thereabouts was federal money.
That's correct.
Of course, I've used ours as well. And only $1,000 out of your office. And the detail, my recollection was printing, mailing. It attributed absolutely nothing, I guess, to staff time. And a way to read that is either you guys have enough extra time where you can absorb it, or your staff time is worth nothing.
I think that's true, that there wasn't any staff time included in those cost figures. We have a three-person HAVA, Help America Vote Act, staff that is doing an array of Help America Vote Act projects. This was just one of many.
Would I assume correctly that other candidates could get a hold of this list at the same price?
I mean, they could certainly obtain it from us for free. I mean, we would have no reason to charge them.
Did you read the letter?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering on the particular issues that it suggested affect the 18-year-olds, the quality of your education, amount of the minimum wage, access to beaches and forests, whether your doctor's trained, protection of civil rights. But what did you mean by that? What civil rights did you have in mind when you said that?
Would you prefer... answer that?
Well, I think protection of your civil rights would be all the civil rights that each of us has as a citizen of this state and of this country. There's a whole series of rights that we have that would be issues that people might be concerned about.
That's, I mean, it's an interesting list of issues. Why didn't you include, perhaps, are you interested in government waste, of overregulation, of Oregon's excessively high income tax rate? How did this list of issues get culled?
I don't know specifically how the specific issues list of issues got developed, because I was not directly involved in the development of the list of issues on that letter, so I can't answer.
Even though
your question
came in your envelope and you signed the letter.
Right.
You're aware then it also said that there's a question mark here. I'm not there yet, but I'm getting a little sensitive. It says, out of 100 Oregonians, only 24 actually voted, and only 12 of them were under the age of 60.
Right.
Do you want 60-year-olds making all the decisions?
Right. I would invite you, Representative Miller, to join me at a high school anytime you want, because I've probably gone to over 75, maybe 80 high schools
around
the state.
My daughter just went through high school, so I was there lots.
Right. So I've gone to lots of high schools talking about the issue of the fact that young people are not participating in the democratic process to the degree that older citizens are. I think it's wonderful that older citizens are participating. I would like younger citizens to participate at the same level that older citizens do.
Well, one of the things, you probably are aware that I called your office about this, naively thinking that mailings like this during an election year somehow probably have an effect of boosting those who are named on the letterhead. My additional concern, whereas I can see some nexus between your office inspiring voting, that's been the tradition of the Secretary of State's office, I'm wondering what was the reason for putting on the Superintendent of Public Instruction's name here as well? What's the linkage between her office and voting? that is unique to that office as opposed to anyone sitting here, the governor?
I have worked, to answer your question, I have worked closely with Superintendent Castillo to visit high schools and encourage younger people to vote. So that's the connection, is that it has been something that she's been involved with and concerned about.
Is that something the state treasurer has not been concerned with?
I can't say that.
You haven't worked with him.
I can't say that Treasurer Edwards is not concerned. I assume he is concerned, but I've not worked with him, nor does it fit in his normal purview to be encouraging high school students to vote.
Well, I hate to be suspicious during an election year, but I think that was not appropriate to include her on this mailing. Again, I think it's marginal that you all are doing this. You know, at some point, I suppose we could ask educators to advise that voter registration cards are freely available in all kinds of public places, and that if young people care to vote, they absolutely can, and we don't need to spend whatever amount of money it is to either discredit 60-year-olds or tell them to go down and vote somewhere, try to write some letter of inspiration. I mean, if we're serious about either Oregon's financial challenges or the federal government's deficits, I guess I'm looking at a lot of expenditures that certainly I wouldn't view as critical to the future of this country or the state. Again, given that there are other alternatives already in place, and the voter registration cards, I see them every day when I just go to the post office. It's pretty simple, and maybe what we ought to do is inspire young people to be responsible rather than force feeding them. Say, you know, if you're interested, and maybe that's probably the larger challenge, is making them think, and I agree with you on this, is making them think that their participation is relevant and can have an impact. But I just, from the financial side, I saw this, and like I say, on the heels of the Hooley publicly paid for campaign piece, I got a little uptight. So thank you for, and thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, Representative Miller, for that illuminating.
I know you're going to miss.
President Butler, do you have a question?
It's tough to follow that act, Mr. Chair.
Yes, it is.
I just wanted to make certain that the overall costs associated with the have a request that we have before us estimate that they're going to be county contributions in the form of probably in-kind and those kinds of things. I'd just like to know and have some assurance that when we see this item again before us, that we've got the Association of Oregon Counties contribution and some input from those folks, and that we know that it's on the record.
Got that? Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Let me just add that all the expenditures that we undertake are basically outlined in more general terms in a plan we developed, the HAVA plan, that had county officials, county clerks, legislators, other folks working on developing. So this is all based on a plan that we are now in the process of revising, and we will make sure that we touch base with we would touch base with the clerks. We'll touch base with the Association of Oregon Counties.
Thank you.
Okay, a motion for deferral. Any objections?
Okay.
Let's see, who is the last here? Senator Dukes.
You have to carry a motion to defer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, you can start off easy.
I'll take that.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
There'll be more. Item number two, Monica, special election costs.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The request is to allocate $1,695,552 from the emergency fund to cover the cost of the special election held on February 3rd, 2004. LFO is recommending a slight revision to that since publishing the letter and the request. Actual costs were certified, so you're going to save $207. I pinched every penny out of my coat. So the recommendation from LFO is to allocate $1,695,314 from the E-Fund to cover the costs of the special election.
And you get 10% of savings. We decided that yesterday.
Yes, I'll buy you a coffee.
Where are you going to find that cheap a cup of coffee?
Well, I disagree with this, Monica. I think everybody that voted for this in the legislature needs to split the cost because I told them it was a dumb idea.
It apparently was.
Apparently was, yeah. All right, any discussion on the motion?
I move the recommendation to LFO, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any objection? So ordered. Tom? No, I'm dead. Okay. We want to do number four next. Is that what you said?
Yes. I think we're going to do number four first. Mr. Chair, again, from the Secretary of State, the request is to allocate $712,807 from the Emergency Fund for the publication and mailing of the 2004 General Election Voters Pamphlet. And before giving the recommendation, you might want to hear from the Secretary of State on their plan.
Sure. We've done this similar before. It worked pretty well. So I think it's not a bad idea. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, this relates to the 2004 General Election Voters Pamphlet. And once again, I'm happy to come before the subcommittee with some good news. You asked us to save more money in the voters pamphlet last time I appeared before you, and I'm happy to say that we were able to do that. The February 2004 special election, we saved 29%. We reduced the space requirements in that special election voters pamphlet by 29%. That was mostly measures. And then in the May primary ballot, you allocated $373,000, and we spent $314,000 because we saved space. And those $55,000 or $59,000 in savings are applied to the general election voters pamphlet. So those savings are, I mean, the money's carried forward into the general election voters pamphlet.
That's less John's 10%, right?
That's right. Yes, absolutely. That's right. And we feel very good about the split that's been proposed by LFO dividing it almost in half. Basically, the $323,000 will pay for printing costs, and we need to do those sooner than the next emergency board. And we'll then have the $390,000 is... for basically it's for mailing, but whatever savings we are able to come up with in printing will reduce the cost of the mailing. So we think that this is a very sensible approach to really do it in a very cost-effective way. And we're very hopeful that the kind of savings we were able to achieve in the primary and the special election are going to all be, we're going to be able to carry those savings into the general election voters pamphlet. The only thing I have to say, I always have to say this, is we don't control how many measures are on the ballot or how many arguments are made or how many, well, we do know how many candidates there'll be. So that's all I have to say is we're never sure how many arguments and how many measures, so we don't know what the costs are going to be until it all happens.
Okay. You don't know how many candidates are going to be. The third-party folks haven't had their
good
conventions
point.
And such.
That's correct. You're right. You're absolutely correct.
More.
Thank you.
Senator Representative Miller.
How many voters' pamphlets do you print?
It's in the neighborhood of 1.5. Excuse me. In the neighborhood, Representative Miller, of 1.6 million.
How many people voted in the last election?
Well, in the primary?
Well,
considerably less than that. Less than.
How about the general? Since that's what we're, I think, talking about, right?
Well, in the 2002 general, we were in the neighborhood of 60%. In the 2000 general, we were just shy of 80%
of
registered voters.
And that would be
number of registered voters is about 1.5 1.8 million.
1.87 million people is the current number of registered.
So you have at least one pamphlet per registered voter.
We send one pamphlet per household, Representative Miller. That's the cheapest way for us to handle the mailing costs. So we don't specifically address them. We just send them to all households.
All households. There's all households where there is a voter that resides there, or just all households?
All households.
Mr. Chair, let me just make sure. We get the absolute cheapest postage rate by sending it to all households. If we sent the voters pamphlet to specifically registered voters, our costs would probably quadruple in terms of postage costs, because the post office deals with bulk mail, particularly with a voter registration card in it, deals with bulk mail that's to all households at a very, really cheap rate. And if we address them to specific people, their costs go way up. So we save money by sending it to all households.
And would you find it less expensive or impractical to just have the voters' pamphlets available like a voter registration card at certain public institutions, and people who were interested in having one could go pick it up, as opposed to it being mailed?
My belief is that people make significant use of the voters' pamphlet as they mark their ballots, particularly when you have a number like the general election 4 years ago. We had 26 measures on the ballot. People made use of the voters' pamphlet, and I have no interest in making it that much more difficult for voters to understand what they're voting on and be educated about it by making them have to go get a voters' pamphlet someplace. I think that we all live very, as you know, we all live very busy lives, and people have trouble.
Not me.
Okay. Well, you're good. Good for you. And people have trouble just getting the information they need. So I believe very strongly that we should do everything we can to get the information to people as effectively and easily as we can so that it fits into their very busy life. And that's sort of our philosophy. It's not just my philosophy. It's been the philosophy of the Secretary of State's office for a long time. Is basically to make sure that people have access to this information as easily as possible.
Any more policy questions you'd like to submit to the?
Well, I've been interested in the voters' pamphlet for a long time. In fact, I think it's certainly useful in terms of some of the issues, although I do continue to believe that we ought to recover the costs in a more aggressive way of those people who buy argument space, pro or con. It's a loser for the state of Oregon, and certainly an invitation to buy multiple arguments. Continue to wonder about the candidate insertions, where only a brief portion at the top are you required to be honest, and the rest of it, I appreciate your sense that it's great people have information, but when it's purely puff and not necessarily correct, makes you wonder about the value of the whole exercise.
Mr. Chair, I can and Representative Miller, I agree with you in the sense that I believe very strongly that the voter's pamphlet should be required to pay its own way. It should not be subsidized to the level it is by the general fund. If you remember last session, the Secretary of State had a bill to basically increase fees, and particularly measure argument fees, to have the arguments paid for. We will be back next session with a very similar kind of bill to pay for the cost of the voters' pamphlet. Because I really agree with your view of it. It's not something that really the general fund should be subsidizing.
Further discussion. Okay, the motion, the recommendation.
The LFO recommendation.
All right. Any objection?
The only question I've got, Mr. Chair, is that the staff was eager to find the savings of a few hundred dollars last round. If you total up the amounts of involvement to come up to the $712,807, really this ought to be allocating $322,807. And conforming with the request, however, recognizing that that can be made up in a second round of funding, I would go ahead and defer to the LFO recommendation of 323.
So you'll watch out, dog, that $200.
I'll
carry
it.
So ordered. I'll carry it. Back to number three.
Mr. Chair, this is the final request this time from the Secretary of State, and it is to increase the other funds expenditure position by $50,000 for an audit of the state's pharmacy benefit administrator.
Okay, pretty straightforward. Any questions, discussion?
I did have just a couple of questions. The original estimate was $50,000 for the audit, in my reading of the information. Now the total cost is estimated to be $100,000. Is that exactly what it's going to be? I assume you've reviewed that, Mark. I just wondered where the federal matching does come back in this process, or when it comes back.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, as my understanding, the RFP is still out on the street, so we do not know what it's actually going to cost. The discussion during session, as I understand it, was $50,000 general fund was appropriated for this. There was further discussion at the Joint Legislative Audit Committee about doing a more in-depth study. The audit committee recommended to the emergency board that the Secretary of State and Department of Human Services, OMAP, seek federal matching dollars for this, and they believe that they can do that through OMAP at this point. So I'm not sure if the memo of understanding is now in place, but I know that they're working on it between the agencies. And additionally, once the costs of the audit are known, it's my understanding the Secretary of State will bill the Department of Human Services. They will then pay the Secretary of State. So that's why it's going to be other funds rather than federal funds coming into the Secretary of State.
I guess then I'd come back to my original question, and that was how the original cost estimate of $50,000 was computed and reserved by the legislature in 2003.
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, I don't know the background on that. My best understanding of that is it was a shot in the dark of about $50,000, and they were going to see what they could get for the audit.
Because they didn't think they could sell $100,000 with you, so they thought they'd lowball you. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You know how this works, Tom.
Well, if you just total up the number of audits and take them, divide up the amount, I just wondered what we were getting into these.
All right. Any other discussion? Any objections to the approval? Okay. So ordered. Let's see. Senator Messerly.
Is this an end of session thing?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you.
Et al.
Pleasure.
Number 51.
Mr. Chair, this is a request.
Another person's gotten punished. You and Cleary, who else screwed up in this outfit?
Well, there's some prison out.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
This is a request from the Department of Administrative Services. The Employment Relations Board was before the Emergency Board in January with a request for staffing. Some limited duration positions were approved pending an audit, an internal audit by the Department of Administrative Services, and they are here today to report on that audit and activities since then.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Teresa McHugh. I'm here as the acting director of the Department of Administrative Services. And we did receive instructions from the last emergency board to do an internal audit. We did do that. The audit team was actually composed of folks from three agencies, the Department of Administrative Services, but Lottery and the Public Employee Retirement System actually provided staff assistance as well to go in and do a thorough review of the mechanics of the agency, look at the cases, look at a lot of the issues that were laid out. And a lot of things were found as a result in terms of things that are management issues as well as resource issues around adequate research tools, equipment, et cetera. It is a small agency, over the years a lot of things have happened in terms of not making some of those investments. We have been working on providing assistance from another state agency. We've got some folks out there. We are not prepared at this time to say we need permanent additional resources. We would rather come in and, based on the findings that we found, see if getting some of the management structures in order provide what the agency needs. We may find and still need to come back and talk to you, but we think it would be premature at this point to say that we permanently need those positions. So we will continue to do that. In the meantime, the Human Resource Services Division of DAS will also continue to finish the review of all the positions and the classifications and what is needed over time. And probably the one thing really outstanding that was a request, well, two things, another one that we're working on is actually taking a review of how it compares to other states. We have an intern from Willamette who will be looking at that. The big one left out that didn't really end up getting reviewed in detail was the funding, ongoing funding mechanism, which is obviously very important, but that is also on the list to make sure before we come back in 2005 to the session that we are thoroughly looking at that and the appropriate funding mechanism based on all the different programs and the different folks that are attached to this program. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Teresa. If I read the report correctly, this agency is really screwed up, but at least we know it. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we found that there were a number of things through the years that had accumulated, and there were some significant things, some of which were management issues and some of which were just getting by with lack of research tools and some of the access that is needed. The agency has worked hard to identify some savings to actually start making some movement on using some of the better tools and being able to do that internally. And again, I think that's in some ways that's a precise assessment of they are on their road to getting it back into shape and having the right policies and procedures, for example, having those in place.
Okay, well, the benchmarking, you're going to work on that this summer. I think that's a useful tool.
Correct.
That's one of the ones that I use a lot. And your other reference, the cost allocation, I think that's a very, very important policy thing that we need to get into next session. We're not going to get into now, obviously, but
you
take a look at who's incurring the cost and how much they pay, and that'll be a big thing.
And, Mr. Chair, just in the scope of the time between the last e-board and this one, we focused on the management issues that were there, and given the nature, did not get to really that discussion. But we understand that's a requirement and needs to be resolved before we come into session.
Yeah, Joan, okay. So a lot of work ahead of us on this small agency. But what else are we doing this week? Right? Okay, knowledge received, reports, recommendation. We'll all move. Any objection? So ordered. Representative Miller, you don't have any marks down here. Would you mind carrying that one?
At least nothing regarding the carrying bill.
There you are.
Thank you.
32.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Military Department, and today we're here to seek permission for an increase in limitation for our Anderson Readiness Center project here in Salem. Specifically, we're requesting an increase of $1,013,575 in capital construction other funds limitations with $797,225 of that amount unscheduled. In addition, we're requesting $324,650 in capital outlay other fund limitations. In February, we applied for a state homeland security program grant funds administered by the Oregon State Police Criminal Justice Division. The grant request was for terrorism incident prevention, communications, and force protection equipment to be installed at the recently constructed Anderson Readiness Center here on State Street, here in Salem. In April 2004, the Homeland Security Program awarded $216,350 of our grant request, and contingent upon approval of today's limitation request, we're ready to proceed with the improvements. The funds will be used to construct a secure compartmentalized information facility, SCIF, which is capable of receiving and processing and coordinating top secret information. We don't have one currently in the state. The grant would also provide blast protection walls around two critical communication antennas on the northeast part of the facility. In addition, the grant would fund both fixed and portable communications equipment that would make us interoperable with other state first responders. The grant administrator has indicated that the remaining $797,225 of our request has been moved to the capital or the critical facility infrastructure list, with the potential of being funded in the near future. The additional funds would be used for building entrance security enhancements, a north perimeter fence, security fence, a mechanical system, chemical, biological mitigation system, a vehicle inspection camera system, installation of controlled access compound gates, a glass breakage detection system, and a perimeter fence intrusion detection system. We hope to receive these funds by the end of July, and we need to have them under a contract in place by the 1st of August and have the funds expended by September 30th. That's part of the 2004 required grant conditions. And the next emergency board isn't until September, so we are requesting the limitation now with the provision that the limitation be on schedule until we receive the funds, actually get them. And as you know, this the Anderson Readiness Center is the home of the Oregon State Police Law Enforcement Data System, Northern Command Center, Oregon Emergency Management, Oregon Department of Transportation, Northwest Transportation Operations Center, Oregon Military Department Emergency Operations Center, and the Emergency Operations Center for the Governor. These proposals with this federal money would greatly enhance the state's ability to secure that particular facility. And that concludes my testimony and pending your questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. Any discussions, Representative Butler?
Just a couple of questions. Is it typical that we unschedule the funds until they arrive on a federal project? Is that typically how we do that? The other issue was, in light of the reports of the 9/11 Commission, this issue of the interoperability of our communications equipment, how realistic is that in Oregon? Are we as far behind as the 9/11 Commission indicated they are back east?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I read the report. I read the specific report about the interoperability of the New York Fire Department and the Police Department, and it was horrific. And I think if you were to really thoroughly examine the same operation or the same situations here in this state, you'd find it either equally as bad or worse. It's just simply not been a priority of governments, and particularly when you have aged equipment. If you take a look at the CSEP program that Emergency Management has administered over at the Umatilla Army Depot, you'll find the model, I think, for the state. And there is an interoperability committee working constantly with the state, with local, county, city, and state fire, police, first responders, and they're coming up with recommendations. These are little pieces of that. There simply isn't enough money to make everybody interoperable at this point. Just it's impossible, I mean, given our current status.
I guess that was my question. I wondered how far $325,000 was going to take us towards the interoperability of those communications. If that just sets up, you know, a firewall to allow better access or lesser access to this particular unit, but I just wanted to be sure, because I'm told that the situation in New York wasn't unique, because as I go through my district, I find that the largest cities in my counties can't communicate with the county and can't communicate with the sheriff through their communication systems, and that's I think a problem throughout. I want to know that we're making some headway in Oregon when we do this, when we reserve and appropriate these funds.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I think, again, this interoperability committee has been meeting now for about a year and a half, and they're setting standards. They're trying to get people, if you do find money, grant money, you know, local government money, whatever money you can do, then you need to be headed in certain directions so we can talk to one another, and that's one of the big issues that we've always had. Our radio systems are on a total different bandwidth than local government and fire and police folks. So we can't talk to them. We can be up in the air flying or doing whatever we're doing, and we simply don't have the communication capability. And we revert to certain very, I guess, Rube Goldberg style kind of operations to order to communicate. We've learned that on the forest fires particularly. We have radio sets for all of our aircraft now that we've purchased over the years out of federal monies that the National Guard Bureau provided to in order to be able to talk to the forestry people. But we still have folks that have a little handheld, and hopefully it'll work, and hopefully, you know, you can get the job done. And this is just another step in that pyramid that we're trying to build. But I will assure you that this committee is very well representative of local government, very well representative of fire and police folks, and they meet once a month, and they're constantly reviewing, looking at all local government initiatives to go after this kind of money. So we're not going out and buying a radio set or a communication system that simply is unique to that particular district or that particular entity. So we're in the right direction. It's just a simple matter of having the money to build it as we go.
Who runs this committee? I'm sorry.
No,
Mr. Chairman, the governor Kitzhoffer actually, his administration set it up. The chair of it right now is the chief fire chief at Tualatin Valley Fire Department. And I can't tell you his name. I'm sure he's well known. Fire marshals involved in the state police, local, I think Portland PD's on it. We sit on it, several different state entities, state government entities.
I think I've seen some of their stuff. They've got a long-range planning document.
Yes, sir.
Or vision document.
Yes, sir, they do.
Right, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yes, sir. And it's,
we know where we need to go. It's just got to chip them off a little bit of a time.
It's a huge, huge cost.
Okay, that's, I thought so. At least somebody's looking at this animal. Yeah. Joan?
If all of the local governments, police, fire, counties, EMTs, all have different systems, how do we ever get you linked up? I mean, I watched what it took in Columbia County, and they're fairly well, at least one end of it, fairly well communicating now. But that was a lot of dollars for one little county. And it appears that they're all different, and that in many counties, police and fire are not on the same system, never mind the ambulance and the rest of them. So,
well, and
you're wondering, is there real hope for the future?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, I think that's exactly what this committee has been struggling with. And I'll use the example of Northeast Oregon, where you have Umatilla County, Morrow County, you got the Army, who owns the Umatilla Army Depot. So you had all these competing interests in here, and everybody had a different radio system. They all went to a different repeater. They all went to a different Motorola versus, you know, some other kind. And the solution there was a 450 megahertz system that is rather state-of-the-art, and it can dance around kind of like your scanner does and pick out, you know, different people that are calling on the net. And by getting all in that one bandwidth, they were able to combine everybody and be able to talk to one another. And they literally, that I forget how many millions that was, and the Army paid for it because of the burning, you know, the gas, the nerve gas burner. It was staggering. It was like $4 or $5 million just for those two counties and that surrounding area and then into Washington. So to answer your question, it is a huge, huge elephant. And I think the only solution, given our relative nature of risk versus, you know, the other needs throughout the country, and I think you probably read that if you read the 911 report, and it's a big elephant, we're going to have to take it one bite at a time. And I think that's why this interoperability committee is so important, and how they focus on bandwidth, where they're going to be in the bandwidth, who's going to be on it. We have places in Oregon, as you well know, and you get down into in certain parts of the terrain, the geography fixes it. So if you don't have satellite telephones or satellite communication, you're not going to communicate. You just can't because of the mountain ranges. So there are challenges that are far beyond my expertise to really sit here and discuss with you. I would invite the legislative, this committee, or any committee, in fact, in the legislature, to invite this interoperability committee in and give you a full briefing on it, because I think it'd be fascinating to learn more about this. It's not a simple solution, and we're not going to get it all done at a single time. And again, you're dealing with entities like special fire districts. You've got city and county governmental agencies, and you know, and we all know what that's like dealing with interagencies. Is you got certain strong wills that typically you know, you got to set that aside and be able to deal on the larger picture, and that's difficult in some senses, but. Like I said, the good news is that they're doing this, and they're meeting constantly to come up with these solutions. There are some, throughout the United States, there are some governmental entities that have done this and done it fairly well, but they spend a ton of money doing it.
I think it would be an interesting report to have, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering realistically, I think we should be putting money into it and doing what we can, but in the next 10 years, I'm curious as to whether there's any real hope that we're going to swallow this elephant.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, I think 10 years is probably a very optimistic estimate.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
If I was looking at it in a 10-year cycle, given all the different entities we have in the state.
Well, at the very least, why I'm somewhat comforted, at least we have a state organization that new purchases are going to fit into the mix.
Correct.
New stuff.
I agree
with that. The retrofit is going to be welcoming, but at least we're not continuing to be stupid the way I understand
it. No, I think, except that if a compatible system doesn't exist in Pickett County, then either new purchases aren't going into that county, or you're going to have to retrofit before you can make those new purchases work if they're going to be on a compatible
system. Well, I guess what I'm, the freak's the freak. You either go to single channel or you go multi-channel. So the new purchases at least will be compatible. They'll have to buy multi-channel. But
Mr. Chairman, what I'd recommend, given, again, my limited knowledge about this whole field, is that perhaps you invite Bev Vanell in, who's now the head of the Office of Homeland Security, and ask her to give you a synopsis of this particular work group's activities and what they're up to, because I'm sure it would be enlightening, and I can assure you that they have turned a lot of stones trying to come up with the right solutions and working with local governments. Again, this has been voluntary. It's not mandated, and the first responders and everybody involved in this business has thrown in on this initiative because they recognize the importance of it. So I think that's the good news.
Isn't the question, do they need some legislative help? Are there some proposals out there?
I'd like to see what the plan is for the future and how it's broken down by year, by biennium, and who all the players are that are going to participate. Clearly the federal government has an agency and a budget, or several agencies and a budget that can help, and you would expect the state to be involved. We got a little preview of this with the 96 floods. One of the worst hit areas in the entire state was Vernonia, and it was completely inaccessible to anyone. You couldn't get in, you couldn't get out by telephone, by walkie-talkie, by anything. And we saw other areas where you had the same problems, and that was just a little. I mean, bad as the 96 flood was for us, that was little compared to what the kinds of things they're talking about today. So I'm just curious as to how the elephant's going to be carved up, and whether they've looked at time, been able to even to look at timelines. I mean, they haven't been going on that long, and who all the partners are that might realistically be able to pay for it, whether the local partners are willing to go for a bond or for a new levy because they're districts, or just how that conversation be. I'm sure they pulled all the right people, and so they're having those conversations.
It might be worth a phone call, Susan, just to see if we can get an update.
Mr. Chairman, I might just add a little anecdote on the 96 flood. It was over 24 hours before the state, quote-unquote, emergency management, asked anybody, even knew that Vernonia had a problem. And that was because some Spartan young man hiked out because the roads were shut and finally got to communications, and just so happened that he was an Oregon National Guardsman. He called our headquarters. We sent a helicopter up to check it out, and it looked like, it was unbelievable. It was just totally unbelievable. And nobody knew. Nobody knew. Both folks in Columbia County didn't know.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't communicate. Nobody at state level knew, and we flew up satellite phones.
They want to come back.
Communication.
Come back.
I think that'd be a perfect setup.
Well, no food, questionable water. It was a lot of homeless people.
All right. I'm sorry. Senator Messerly.
As we're hearing this discussion, it seems to me that, first of all, it'd be nice for the future legislature to get an idea what the total cost might be.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the biggest problem that we're facing is, as new technology comes online, where do you go? And I can go back in our family business when the computers started in. We spent an awful lot of money continually upgrading because of the new technology, and spent thousands and thousands of dollars on a small business. And I can see the same thing happening here. You've got these small districts and police stations and fire departments that might be, in a way, forced to get in on the bandwagon, and 2 or 3 years later, throw the whole thing out and start over again. So we're in a tough spot, but it's a huge needs for it.
Oh, I need to borrow your abacus when we get out. Yeah. Got some stuff I need. Okay. Further discussion. Approve the request. Any objections? Okay. So ordered. Let's see. Senator Dukes, you're back on the list.
Okay.
Let's see. 36. Mike, would you stick around for a minute? I need to talk to you when you get all done.
We're all here on this next one.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I'm currently the acting director of the Oregon Youth Authority. As you may recall, ballot measure 28 in the 2003 calendar year required the Oregon Youth Authority to close 4 of the 5 regional youth correctional facilities, reducing the capacity for close custody by 250 beds. The facilities that were closed are located in Albany, Burns, Prineville, and Warrenton. The 2003-5 Legislative Assembly did restore 25 beds to the Burns facility and 25 beds, which we will be opening in Warrenton in July of this year. Lynn and Clatsop counties have continued to operate detention units in both Warrenton and the Albany facility, which leaves the only facility that we have that is currently unused, the Ochoco facility in Prineville. Cook County requested to the governor's office that we consider alternative uses for this facility as opposed to leaving it vacant, and they specifically requested that there be consideration for the military to use this facility as an armory. There are some long-term ramifications of a transfer of property, those being the reduction of the 50 secure beds in the Youth Authority's overall capacity. It is a proposal by the Youth Authority that the transfer and the use of the Prineville facility, in fact, be moved to the National Guard, and that consideration be given for the future construction of 225-bed units onto existing regional facilities, either in Warrenton, Albany, Roseburg, or down in Burns. The reason for this is the operating cost is 60% of what it would be for a 50-bed facility. So it is cost-effective to make the existing facilities larger, and it does provide an immediate occupancy for the Ochoco facility, which is deteriorating rapidly, just sitting vacant. This past winter, we had a main water main in the gymnasium break, and that caused damage to the gym floor, which will have to be repaired or replaced now. And it's just not a good situation to leave a piece of property completely vacant and unused.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Military Department. Bob did a good job of explaining how this thing kind of came to us, and we're certainly willing and would like very much to move into the Ochoco facility in Prineville, which in this case we would close our Redmond facility and relocate that unit to Prineville. The facility is located within about 4 miles difference to our training area. It's 4 miles further from Ochoco to our training area than it is from the Redmond Armory. The Redmond Armory was built in 1951. It's certainly outlived its capable use for us, although we still use it and we still have plenty of armories out there that are 1951 models or later. But nevertheless, this is an opportunity that we think would work. The unit that is scheduled to go into that is Troop G of the 82nd Cavalry, and they are being deployed at the end of the month to Iraq. So they will not be in the area. The soldiers won't be in the area for about 15, 16 months. So it gives us time to do the things that we need to do. We will have a limited crew there. We have a rear detachment that stays back on each unit. And it's typically the young recruits, that, a couple of the old dogs, and a lot of the young kids that have just enlisted and have not met the qualifications and cannot be deployed. So there'll be a small element there during that period. And also we use the training area, so we'll have visiting units come in and use this facility, and it'll work for us to do that.
Good idea, gentlemen. Any other discussion?
I'll move the recommendation.
Okay. All right. So ordered.
Thank you.
Let's see. That's me. $45. Gentlemen, I'll take this for just a second.
Chair Dukes, members of the committee, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm the director of the Department of State Lands. We have two emergency board requests before you today. The first one is regarding South Slough. This is the South Slough National Estuary down in Charleston, south of Coos Bay. We're requesting an increase in limitation for operations and construction projects. Since the state biennial fiscal period and the annual federal fiscal years don't line up, we usually don't know with precision how much we're going to receive from the federal government at the time we're putting together a budget during the regular legislative session. Also, the closer we get to starting projects, the better our cost estimates are. We've worked real closely with LFO and DAS to refine our request, and we've modified the request so that we will leverage existing other funds, thus avoiding asking for more other funds to match the federal funds. This includes money for both operations and construction. This is a federal grant, part of our regular operations and construction grant that we get from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And we're okay with the LFO recommendation.
Any questions? She did. Okay. Good.
Madam Chair, I move recommendation, the LFO recommendation.
Okay. The LFO recommendation has been moved. Is there any objection? So ordered.
The second agenda.
Oh, Carrier. Senator Messerly.
The second agenda item deals with the State Lands Building. That building is located at the North Capitol Mall. Our building needs ceiling cleaning and masonry repair. We're now that building's now about 14 years old, and we'd like to get the work done this season to avoid higher costs, especially since we have leaks and cracks that must be repaired prior to the rainy season. When we developed our 03-05 budget, we didn't have a solid estimate for the project, and also construction of the north building postponed proceeding with this needed work. We now have a good estimate from DAS, and because DAS is doing a number of projects in addition to our building together, we're able to take advantage of cost savings by combining this with that package of DAS projects. We concur with the LFO and DAS recommendation for increasing the expenditure limitation and unscheduling the amount until we have the actual costs.
I just had a question of legislative fiscal. The other funds limitation, this must come from the capital reserve that we have for the building maintenance. Is that right?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, this would be from the common school fund. That would be the source of revenue for this project, and it would be part of the capital improvement budget.
Other questions?
No.
That was a motion to approve the LFO recommendation.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Okay, is there any objection? So ordered.
Thank you very much.
My carrier.
Miller written on
it. Okay. Same. Representative Miller. Still not used to that change you made. Okay. 42.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Katie Coben. I'm the Director of the Department of Agriculture. Our first item before you this morning is a request to apply for federal funds to continue our work on Yoni's disease, which is an animal disease that affects dairy herds. This would be the third year of Oregon's participation in this federal program, whereby we do outreach to the dairy industry and veterinarians in the state to attempt to identify herds that are infected and put procedures in place to reduce or eliminate those infections. To date, 150 of Oregon's 380 dairy farms have participated in the Yoni's prevention program. Right now, about 80 dairies are continuing to test cows as part of their management plans. We have federal data that indicates that at least 35% of Oregon's dairies are likely infected. This is an increased amount than what we have received in the past that will allow us to do a larger number of tests and outreach to the community, and we're requesting your approval to apply for these federal funds.
Did I hear you say 30% of Oregon's dairies were likely infected? Because when we heard this the last time around on the other sheet, we were told that it's a disease that didn't exist in Oregon, and we wanted to make sure it didn't come into Oregon.
Well, this little sucker is somehow related to, or a distant cousin to, mad cow, isn't it?
Chairman, Senator Dukes, actually, it's not related to
it's
the
not.
BSE.
Okay.
Issue, and National Animal Health Survey that's referenced in here in 96 actually did. It was a national survey, it wasn't just Oregon, and it certainly is incidence. And actually, that was just a kind of a survey. Once we have these dairies have started.
You need to put your name on the record.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Roger Huffman. I'm the administrator of the Animal Health and Identification Division. The incidence is actually in the survey was around 35%, but we're finding it's higher as we're working these dairies and doing these tests. Part of this this whole thing is there's a sister survey going on ongoing monitoring of herds. And it goes along with the actual test itself, and we've had several companies. We've been trying to specifically identify what rate of incidence this is at and how significant it is and how each test relates to the parameters of whether they're positive or negative. So there's an ongoing piece to this, Yoni's. One is to go and get all dairies to just do the initial testing, and the second one is to go on an ongoing management and testing protocol. So clearly it is, it has been a problem and still continues to be a problem.
Interesting. I very clearly remember us being told last time it wasn't, and we wanted to keep it out. Are they testing individual cows? Something.
Chairman Dukes, originally there was a, when we started this several years ago, we just did 30 cows in each herd. It's kind of what we figured that was statistically we'd be able to find it. Now, through this grant, as nationally, they have seen that Oregon has been pretty active and we're finding animals. They have actually given us increased funding to try to get our hands around what we do have. So the incidence is clearly higher.
When you find a cow with Yoni's disease, are they killed? What do you do?
Chairman Dukes, that is left up to the individual dairy. You know, in the later stages of the disease, clearly their production falls off. And depending on the milk price and the feed price and all those things, it's more of an economic decision for them at the time. But as part of this, once we find out what the rate of incidence in the herd is, the veterinarian and private veterinarians work with the management to eliminate the incidence of disease so their economic losses are much less. So that's really the goal of this, is to figure out how bad of a problem it is and then work towards elimination when the cows are no longer economically feasible. And in some cases, some of those dairymen just decide we don't want to manage out of this. We just want to send all those positive animals to the slaughter, and that's what happens.
Is there any concern about the public? I mean, is this...
Chairman Dukes...
We just went through this whole federal thing of saying that downed milk cows aren't going into the public food arena. They're not going to be ground up for hamburger anymore. Do these cows fit into that? Is there any reason the public should be concerned about them?
Chairman Dukes, it's been loosely associated with Crohn's disease in humans. There's a similarity in the diseases. It hasn't been proven at this time that actually Yoni's or paratuberculosis is a cause of Crohn's, but it's very similar in humans. Not unlike CJD in humans and then BSC in the cows. They're very similar diseases.
So do we think it's okay that these sick cows go into the food source, become a food source?
Chairman Dukes, actually from a consumption of the cow issue, it doesn't seem to be an issue at all from a food safety side.
So this loose relationship, is that because I go out and visit the cows and then we think maybe that I get it that way and not from eating them?
Chairman Dukes, it would be through the milk.
Through the milk. Do we have anything once a cow is tested as positive? Do we have anything that says their milk no longer goes into the system?
Chairman Dukes, no.
No.
Because there isn't a solid link there, it is not being excluded from human consumption.
I'm sure.
Right.
This disease has been around a long time. When I was in the dairy business years and years ago, it was isolated, but there was few, and at that time it was thought to be due to stress or when you're really pushing the animals to produce. It's not a contagious disease, right? They haven't established that. Is it genetic? Is it due to stress? Or have they, in the research they've done, are they starting to draw any conclusions?
Chairman Duke, Senator Messerly, actually, I guess I can't completely answer the technical side of it, but it's my understanding that clearly the fecal matter is what is one of the things that we test for the disease in. If young animals have access to an animal that has positive fecal paratuberculosis in it, that the young animals can contract it through the soft tissues.
I think, Madam Chair, that at least it's my understanding that this is the biggest part of this problem is the economic impact on the industry. And I think there is concern of the industry that they protect their product and they protect the consumers. But the real need I see for more funding and more research is to protect the production capabilities of the industry.
Chair,
thank you. I just had a couple of questions. Where this is a federally funded project, we're developing database, and clearly this is for database management. My concern is for the maintenance of efforts. Are you doing something for the 2005-2007 budgets where we may not have $306,000 available from federal funds to continue to do the database management for Yoni's disease, and if this is a continuing issue, all of a sudden, Mr. Huffman's comment that this may be associated, and I look at the write-up here, yonis can also be affect beef cattle and is also associated with human disease as well. I've got a son who's affected by Crohn's disease. And all of those years that we were buying milk directly from the dairy, now I'm wondering about it, you know, all of a sudden this has affected me, or potentially could have affected me. So I'm concerned about the maintenance of efforts that may be required for the database, and then what we're going to do relative to the, as Senator Dukes has indicated, you know, where the disease is found, is there going to be an affirmative plan that could affect our dairymen in the state we're in? How are we going to address it?
Senator Dukes, Representative Butler, I can understand your thought process on that. And we, as you can see, this is in the third year. It appears that it's a high enough level on the federal side that there will be continued funding. As I mentioned earlier, Oregon has been proactive and had solid participation from the dairies. We actually they increased the funding for Oregon and decreased it for Washington just because of the quality of our program. What this allows us to do this year, potentially, is to get those other dairies that haven't really been active. As you see, there's still a couple hundred out there that we'd like to at least get a whole herd test on and figure out what the issues are there. This is incentive-based. It pays the veterinary for the time to do the herd management evaluation. It also pays for the collection of the samples and pays the full cost of the tests. If every dairy and every cow was tested in the state, there may end up being a cost share to the dairy producers, but at this time we think that it looks like it would be completely free. So we're really going to push in this next 12 months to get all dairies at least to find out what the incidence in their dairies is and start working towards that. Down the line, we realize that they're, due to the cost of this, the testing, that they're likely, because of the economic incentive, depending on the incidence, up to a couple hundred dollars per animal cost a year in lost production from this disease, that the dairies will continue on in a cost share basis with the state. And clearly we can also show in these studies that those dairies that have had higher levels through management, those levels are being reduced. So it's kind of a big splash at this point.
Let me make sure I understand. What are we going to do next in the out years? What happens after next July?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if there's additional federal resources available that come to the state,
we'll do this
we
again.
Would continue to do this kind of an effort.
And if there's not?
If there's not, then in all likelihood it will be up to the individual dairy owners to continue forward and at their own cost.
All right, so you don't have anything in your budget permanent. Okay. Okay.
And I think I know the LFL staff is going to talk about the federal funds limitation issue. Just in general, share with the committee, we've been cognizant of diseases. Lately, obviously, the mad cow issue and the specific request on yonis. In general, what we're seeing in particular with the global economy and movement of products more freely from country to country is additional opportunities for diseases. So I don't think this is an issue that is going to go away anytime in the future.
That's some of my question, Katie. It seems like we need to think long term. Okay. Yeah, so it's not going to get any better, I don't suspect. Further discussion? Any objection to the recommendation?
Right. Chair, I might want to just add.
There's no objections to any of this stuff.
I know. I'm just giving you another heads up. When we made the original request to you, we did not ask for federal funds limitation. Since we've made that request, we've had our most recent incident with sudden oat death in the nursery industry.
We currently restarted as of yesterday. 10 federal officials have come to Oregon, and we will be receiving federal funds to move through all of our dairy industry and certify our dairy industry as being free from sod. We're not exactly sure how much. I'm sorry, our nursery industry.
Okay.
I was wondering.
different industry. We're not exactly sure how much federal funds we're going to receive yet. We know we are running short of limitations, so the legislative fiscal analyst is suggesting that we receive federal funds limitation for this specific request. In all likelihood, we will be back before the emergency board asking for yet additional federal funds as we get a better sense.
I read all that. No objection to this.
Thank you.
We understand. But now you're going to generate more questions.
No, I don't have a question. I just have a comment, and I wanted to say publicly thank you for the way that you handled the sudden oak death incident in Oregon. And it was handled very professionally and very well. And the first phone call I got, I pretty much panicked because I could see all the big headlines and all of the, you know, we were going to be in bad shape, but it was handled very well. So I want to thank you and staff.
Thank you, Senator. I just have to commend the industry for the proactive work that they've done and really stepped up.
Sure.
When you were ahead, I mean, your folks were working well enough with the feds instead of the whole state getting quarantined. We had a much smaller incident, and that was because of the work of your staff.
Anybody else want to comment on this approved report? Okay.
I know there's two parts to the sudden death of disease, and I understand what you're doing with the nursery stock. What's happening in the forest in Curry County?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, we're seeing very good results in Curry County. The initial infestation that we identified, 3 years ago now, in wild forest land. We've been very aggressive, and the size continues to shrink. We've had surveys this spring that show a few spot outbreaks, but it's something that obviously we'll continue to work on.
Well, Mr. Chair, is there any more outbreaks coming in from California? We're pretty certain that forest outbreak did come from California, isn't that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Messerly, that's what we believe happened, moved up from the south. We, with our aerial surveys in that general vicinity, we're not seeing any additional outbreaks.
Further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Well, let's see. I'm torn. This is a cow issue. We have a cow, man, but it is Jones disease, so I'm not sure who to carry this.
I'll take it, Mr. Chair. I do have some dairy cows in my district. In fact, more than the people in one of my
districts. Actually, it's 43.
Mr. Chairman and members, again, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. I'm joined by Stephanie Howlett, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. We are responding to a budget note that was placed in both of our budgets during the last legislative session, and we were directed to report back to the Emergency Board both in the spring and the fall as we worked forward on this issue. The budget note deals specifically with the setting of total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, under the Federal Clean Water Act. And this is a process that is done by the Department of Environmental Quality. Part of that process impacts the agricultural industry, and it was some very strong interest on behalf of our industry that led to several discussions during the last legislative session with the industry, with the two of us, as well as with Senator Messerly, and ultimately resulted in this budget note. Since the close of session, our agencies have been working with the industry to try to figure out the best way to move forward in handling the budget note. This, if you're not involved in it, I can just tell you in a brief statement, is a very controversial as well as complicated kind of issue in terms of setting these TMDLs, and DEQ, as they've worked through that, I certainly could expand on that.
what we ultimately ended up doing was working with the new Institute of Natural Resources within the Oregon University System, as well as in concert with the industry, and asking them how they might approach developing a new methodology for setting the TMDLs for non-point contributors, which include agriculture, non-point being not coming directly out of a pipe into the water. And as a result of those discussions, the Institute for Natural Resources came up with a recommendation, basically a two-phased approach to dealing with the budget note. The first phase would be a pretty extensive information gathering exercise, including describing the procedures that we currently go through for setting TMDLs, analyzing how other states work through this process, looking into the series of litigation that is currently going on in terms of dealing with agricultural non-point source TMDLs, and any other issues that might be analyzed. Then in phase two, assuming we were given both the green light and the funding to move forward with phase one, the Institute of Natural Resources would actually develop a new research effort and model for setting TMDLs. So what we've come back to you today with is an estimate of what it would cost to do phase one, and the proposed budget there is $61,095.01. Not sure where the one penny came from, as well as kind of this design of what phase one would look like. We've had discussions with the industry. We've connected back with Senator Messerly as well as Representative Morgan. And I think everyone seems to be on board with this would be a way to move forward. The question really is, do we move forward now and receive the funding and move forward with phase one, or do we kind of say our work is done for now and come back during the next legislative session and have further discussions about whether we want to move forward with this effort?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the only thing I would add is that on May 26, some representatives of both of our departments met with Senator Messerly and Representative Morgan, and I have a letter to hand out to you that was in response to some questions that they asked, and attached to the letter is the existing memorandum of agreement between our two departments on the relationship on TMDL, doing TMDLs between our work and their work on the agricultural water quality management plans that just were done to respond to some questions that they had, and particularly around the temperature standard that was newly adopted with some explicit language that you'll see in this letter making it clear that we do not take enforcement action, which I think has been some concern, that the Department of Ag is clearly the authority for the agricultural water quality management plans, not the Department of Environmental Quality. So I would just provide those to you for your information.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to commend both departments. The discussions during the session were based on basically a concern that we get the job done and meet the mandates of the court action, but also not overburden the industry. And I think the industry was interested and concerned that we not jeopardize their position either and that they do the right things. And I just commend both departments for working through this and I think coming up with a time frame, and we don't know exactly what the solution will be yet, but I think it's moving forward in the proper procedure, and I think it'll be done right with stakeholder buy-in in the end, and that's what's going to make the program work. So I do have one question, though. Should we delay this? Is there risk to that in light of potential court action or the judge's decree?
Mr. Chair and Senator Mezzali, if I may respond, the only, I don't think so. There is, there was litigation, as you're well aware, and we did revise the temperature standards as a result of the litigation. Those temperature standards have been approved by EPA. There has been no subsequent litigation on those standards, nor have we heard any word that there may be. The only court decision that is still pending is the Hawes case in northeastern Oregon, which I don't think is going to immediately change anything, and I don't know, we haven't heard any recent word on when that might be decided. So there really is no pending litigation that we're aware of at this point that could change anything.
One clarification for myself, at least, Mr. Chair. The EPA has approved this approach. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mezzali, they have approved the temperature standards. If I'm understanding your question correctly. Yes.
What's going to happen next? We're going to acknowledge receipt of the report that says we ought to do this. What are we going to do?
Mr. Chairman, you need to give us direction about whether you want to fund it at this point in time and move forward with phase one, or hold off and give direction for us to come back to the legislature to continue the discussion, and if that's the case, probably ask us not to report back to the emergency board in the fall because we wouldn't have done anything.
Yeah, that's what I thought. We need to make a decision.
Did DLFO consider the possibility of making a recommendation relative to the $60,000+ out of the general emergency board appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we had considered that, and it's our opinion at this point that it's not enough of an emergency to go forward at this point. We believe that it can wait until a full discussion during the next legislative session and be incorporated in the budget discussions.
So, in other words, the amount that was estimated, $61,095, basically stays the same at the beginning of the 2005 session in your estimation?
We believe so, yes.
Okay.
Are you going to submit $60,000 in your budget?
Mr. Chairman, we were also looking either from direction either from this committee, or potentially we would have follow-up discussions with Senator Messerly and Representative Morgan about their desires for us to come forward with a specific request in our budget.
I'm a little concerned here. The request that we received in our package did not request funding.
That's correct.
And so...
Mr. Chair, Senator Mezzali, it's always within your ability to provide the funding at this point. I think the agencies were reluctant to come forward with the funding request now just because there are a couple of other options, and they really wanted to lay both options out without requesting one.
Mr. Chair, it was commented on earlier, and I find it always enlightening to hear the comment that maybe EPA isn't really pushing for certain things to happen, and we're not under that kind of a edict from the federal agency. It appears that most of this is driven from the courts anyway. I mean, Judge Hagerty's opinion is where we solidly have to be behind. And I'd like to have just some response from the agency heads here as to what kind of an edict we may be under after the recent invalidation of our 1999 approval of our programs, and whether or not that would put some degree and sense of urgency as to some discussion of approving the allocation of a 61095 from the emergency fund at this time, as opposed to waiting until 05, getting ahead of this thing, in other words.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, let me clarify the court decisions that apply to this exercise. First of all, the DEQ, the state, is under a court order to do TMDLs for the entire state. And there is a court-mandated deadline of 2010 to complete all those. And we're working diligently. We're on schedule. There aren't any problems with meeting that court order. The decision that's referred to in this letter was a different lawsuit that actually challenged our temperature standard that was adopted some time ago. That lawsuit
has gone through the court system, and as a result of that lawsuit, we in fact last year had to promulgate a new temperature standard, and this is what Senator Meserle was asking about just a second ago, and had to submit that for approval to EPA. That has been approved by EPA. It has been adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission. That is now on the books, and we are working under that new revised temperature standard, which isn't a whole lot different from the one we had before, but there are a few differences. So we are through all of the legal challenges right now. There aren't any pending. We don't anticipate any hammers falling in that department. Have not heard about any new lawsuits out there.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I might add, the work on setting TMDLs will continue to move forward under the current methodology. The question that the industry was posing was whether there was a different, better methodology for setting the allocation of the TMDL to the ag non-point source parts. So in essence, delaying the work here just means we delay a discussion and a decision to change the methodology, but the work continues to move forward under the current methodology. My understanding from the industry is they are comfortable waiting and continuing moving forward with the way that we're doing things now. Obviously, we will continue to have conversations with them, and I'm sure this will be a topic of discussion during the legislative session.
And if I may add one thing, first of all, I think I didn't identify myself. I'm Stephanie Halleck, the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, the first time I spoke. By moving ahead under the existing arrangement, that would be the memorandum of agreement that I handed out to all of you. That's the agreement that we currently have with the Department of Ag and DEQ and how we do this work. And the question came up was whether or not any revisions might be needed to that memorandum of agreement. And I think Katie just correctly stated that in talking with the industry folks, I think the good thing about this discussion is we really talked through the issue. And I think a lot more understanding has been developed about how the work is being done. And there's a higher comfort level than there was when the budget note was written that we really do communicate and really are working with the industry on this. So I think all parties concerned right now felt that it wasn't necessary to spend that money out of your emergency fund right now to move the process forward.
And that seems to be the consensus as of this morning. Okay.
Well, why don't you guys, acknowledge, receive the report. Why don't you guys kick this around to the course of the summer, and if we need to come back in September, let us know. But probably putting it in your budget may be the simplest, cleanest thing
for now.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might just to clarify, LFO is recommending that they not be required to come back for a second report. The budget will require two reports. And unless something changes, as you said, and there is some desire to bring it forward, we would recommend that they not be required to make another report.
Yep. That's what we're saying. Okay.
All right.
Any objection? Senator Meserle calls this mess. You have to carry the thing. Purse. Hello, Dallas.
Hello.
Where are you?
And you, sir?
Just hunky dory.
You have all the answers.
I just know which questions to avoid.
That's worthwhile.
It's probably yeah. The other guy that got punished for screwing up somewhere. We're not sure where.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Paul Clary, now the executive director of the Public Employee Retirement System. And with me this morning is the vice chair of our board, Brenda Rockland, who was gracious enough to take some time away from her day job as director of the state lottery to appear before you today as well. We are here to request an increase in our budget limitation of $1,005,000. In order to cover rising legal costs associated with both our day-to-day business at PERS, as well as a settlement of of the City of Eugene lawsuit, better known as the Lipscomb lawsuit. I've got a handout here because there were some questions that were that have been raised, and we wanted to give some more detail on what was our originally legislatively adopted budget. And it's my understanding that this was both through the general session plus an addition of, I think, $150,000 through an earlier emergency board action, and the total is $1,025,634. To date, in our existing legal costs, we've already incurred about $1.1 million in legal costs, and then we've got a settlement payment that I want to make clear. We've already paid this money. It was associated with the settlement again of the Lipscomb decision, and I think in January the board announced that they had an agreement in principle to settle this four-year lawsuit between the board and nine different local government employers. And as part of that agreement, we were trying to mirror up with the House Bill 2003 legislation. We agreed to credit earnings for 1999 in accordance with that 2003 reform legislation, which meant we were going to credit them at a rate of 11.3% rather than what the previous board had done, a 20% crediting. We agreed not to reallocate 1999 earnings, which would have really involved us reaching into every member's account and taking money out of that unless the reform legislation is declared invalid. So we agreed with the principle that the legislature had enunciated in the House Bill 2003 legislation that we weren't going to go back in and affect accounts, and indeed some of those accounts associated with people who are already retired. We were going to try to recover this money prospectively. We agreed to change our past practice in calculating money match retirement benefits for members who have variable accounts. We agreed to comply with the statutory directives concerning reserving practices and mortality tables as interpreted by Judge Lipscomb and amended by the reform legislation. We agreed to recalculate the employer contribution rates. And then on a provision that actually was raised by an intervening party, the PERS coalition representing a number of public employee unions, we agreed to transfer money from employer accounts to the contingency reserve consistent with the judge's ruling on this question of employers in the variable. So that was one where the interveners prevailed on that. And then we also agreed to comply with the judge's order to pay the petitioning employers reasonable costs and attorney fees for the litigation. It's my understanding that we received a demand letter for approximately $1.4 million, and through the negotiations of our attorneys and members of the board, we got that down for the main employer group of eight down to $750,000. And then we agreed with Eugene Water and Energy Board to pay $175,000. And because the PERS coalition prevailed on that one issue, we have agreed to pay their attorney fees of $80,000. Now, we have not received an invoice yet from the PERS coalition. So reached this agreement in principle back in January, executed it with the main set of employers latter part of February, made the first payment April 20th, then reached the amended settlement with Eugene Water Enhancement Board on the our Water and Energy Board on April 22nd, made that payment in May, and now because of a combination of both our burn rate on our legal costs to date and that settlement payment, we've not only bounced up against our existing budget limitation, we've exceeded it, and we've gotten to the point where we can't cover these additional costs through internally generated savings without affecting our already challenged services to both our members and our employers. So we're here today before you to request an increase in our limitation to restore some of these costs. We intend to restore the settlement cost by taking money out of the contingency reserve in April, pursuant to the reform legislation. The board credited the maximum amount to the contingency reserve, 7.5% of earnings, and that's somewhere in the $570, $580 million range. And so we would take money out of the contingency reserve, or actually just move it in a book accounting to restore this limitation associated with this with these particular settlement costs. We try to detail in this additional memo some of the dates, some of the actions I've learned in the 3 weeks that I've been on the job, and actually in the last 24 hours, the importance of being very precise in terms of the statements that we make. I want to make it clear that when we talk about dismissal of the plaintiff's claims against the PERS board, we're talking about the claims from the employers. That has been dismissed. There still is, the interveners are still attempting to appeal the Lipscomb decision, if you will. When we talk about the settlement agreement incorporated and negotiated portion of the prevailing parties cost, the prevailing parties include both the plaintiffs, the employers, as well as the PERS coalition. When we talk about difficulty in getting signatures, the various involved parties, the only parties to the agreement were the employers. The coalition was not a party to the agreement, but they were a prevailing party in terms of us agreeing to pay their attorney costs associated with that issue, the employers in the match. I apologize for being clearer in the initial letter that these payments had been made. I've learned not to assume things throughout my career. I think I kind of figured it, since this is something that had happened in January and we'd announced it in January, and people kind of had an understanding that we were making these payments. But we could have been much clearer in that, and we certainly will be in the future. So with that, Brenda has agreed to appear, perhaps from the standpoint if you've got some questions, particularly about the settlement and some of the ongoing litigation, she can help with that.
Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you mentioned that the coalition is trying to appeal. So we've got a group that's appealing the decision that we are making payments on. How does that work? I mean, it sounds like it's not done yet.
Chair Harper, Senator Dukes, certainly the dispute between the employer units and the board is done. That's what the settlement agreement involved. Some of the issues that are raised in that are what the coalition are continuing to raise with the court, and actually they're being raised in a number of different forums as well. They're part of rolled into the reform legislation challenge as well.
Would any of these challenges undo the agreement that you have, or the agreements that you have with employers?
For the record, Brenda Rockland, Vice Chair of the PERS Board. Senator Dukes, let me respond this way. I would say, first of all, there is a motion to dismiss the entire appeal pending in the Oregon Supreme Court in terms of the City of Eugene litigation. That is a motion that the Oregon Supreme Court has yet to act on. And most recently, within the last couple weeks or so, the two parties still left in that litigation, the employer's attorney and Mr. Hartman, I believe have asked the Oregon Supreme Court for argument on the motion to dismiss in terms of whether the controversy is still a live controversy and whether that appeal should go forward. So to some extent, the issue of that resolution of that motion to dismiss, I think, is going to answer some of that question, because if the case is dismissed outright, there isn't going to be any part of the settlement that could be undone. In terms of the agreement with the employers, I think the settlement has been arrived at between the PERS board and the employers, and that matter is in fact at this point settled. Could there be issues that arise in the Strunk litigation that's currently pending in the Oregon Supreme Court in terms of the reform litigation that could potentially have an impact on this settlement in terms of members, potentially? But as to the resetting of the rates for the employers in this particular case, City of Eugene, I think the settlement concludes that matter. And the attorney fee issue as well. As Paul mentioned, we did have a demand to pay $1.4 million in settlement or attorney's fees in the Lipscomb case. Judge Lipscomb had already ordered PERS to pay reasonable attorney's fees, and it was through the efforts of our counsel negotiating with employers' counsel to try to get that amount down from $1.4 million down to $750,000 that we then were able to finally arrive at a settlement agreement. And that amount is precluded then, that we're not going to pay additional settlement costs in relation to that litigation.
Sounds like an awkward situation. On the one hand, there's a definite advantage to calling an end to some of this so the cost doesn't get any higher. But on the other hand, you have people you have no control over who are out there doing what's right for their side and maybe impacting what you're doing.
What a country, huh?
If they prevail, this thing gets tossed out at the Supreme Court level. Does Eugene owe us this money back, or what happens then? Or this?
Well, I'll take a stab at that, Senator Harper.
Or nobody knows.
If one of the things that's going to happen, and we agreed in this settlement agreement, is we're going to have to reach back and adjust member and employer accounts, about 280,000 accounts that we've tried to avoid as part of this settlement agreement. We indicated in that we wouldn't reallocate those earnings unless it was declared invalid, the reform legislation was declared invalid. Then we would have to go back in and implement that part of the judgment. In terms of the attorney fees, again, this is a settlement, and it's a negotiated settlement, and this bill would stand. Some of the issues could create additional work for us and additional expenses for both employers and as well. But this would stand.
So this bill won't go away no matter what happens.
Chair Harper, we certainly once the judge ruled and ordered that we had to pay the prevailing party's attorney's cost, the bill wasn't going to go away. And as a matter of fact, we had requested a stay at both the trial court and the Court of Appeals level, and there wasn't any agreement on that either. So this settlement allowed us to avoid a lot of work and a lot of expenses, obviously a cost associated with it, and that's sometimes a part of a negotiated settlement.
And it's coming from a contingency fund. Did I read that correctly?
Chair Harper, yes, you did.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Judge Lipscomb ordered us to pay, but if it is successfully appealed to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court changes that, then we've paid?
Chair Harper, Senator Dukes, as part of the settlement agreement, we have paid that negotiated portion of the legal costs. You're right.
Senator Harper was asking, what happens if it's overturned? I mean, are we still bound by our settlement agreement because we signed and they signed? But if the basis for that is overturned and we're no longer ordered to pay, I mean, it's all speculation. But I just
right.
Yeah, it's, I guess we'll take that up in this next D board.
Yeah, we would be bound to pay.
It's weird. Yeah. Okay. All right. Any other questions, discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just don't want us to lose sight of the fact that and I recognize the board has all changed, but these are lawsuits against the Public Employee Retirement Board for some decisions that I think that they probably heard very seriously at the time. And the concern that I have is I just wanted to know what the total of these legal costs are that will that have been or will be charged to the fund. Am I reading correctly that the total amount of disbursement for PERS legal costs now exceed $2 million, $2.1 million?
Chair Harper, Representative Butler, that is correct. And we're only a year into the biennium, which is why we had to make this appearance before you. I just can't eat that type of money in the existing budget without affecting services to members and services to employers.
And these are, follow up, Mr. Chad, I'm assuming that these are the attorneys that have represented us that we heard in the PERS committee as we went along, and that is somewhere here the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's office involved in this litigation?
Chair Harper, Representative Butler, yes. Under the legal cost column there, that would be a combination of both the Department of Justice as well as the outside counsel, and I think it breaks down somewhere around $425,000-$450,000 Department of Justice so far, and the remainder of the outside counsel.
Follow up. Legislative Fiscal has that breakout of the attorneys that are involved. I assume they're all Oregon law firms and or lawyers that are qualified to do business in Oregon.
It's in Oregon, yes,
okay.
Sir.
All right.
Okay, further discussion? Objection to the motion? Recommendation? Okay. So ordered.
Thank you.
Mom, you don't want to carry this one? That's right up your alley,
buddy. Mr. Chair, I've got to be out of here a little bit early tomorrow.
I understand. Anybody want this one? If not, I'll take it. Okay.
Looks like you've got Hartman written all over it.
All right.
Chairman, members of the committee, the recommendation here is actually in your binder. They came forward to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology. This is a request at the table for funding to go forward if the governor goes forward with consolidation of some of the data centers. And they just received a report from the consultant. They're in the process of, there's a group vetting that report now to make sure that the business case exists. The governor is expected to make a decision about the middle of July, and if the decision is to go forward with the consolidation of data center, they will need some limitation to, for planning and available facilities that would be needed. So the department is here to make the request, which you don't have before you because it was just finalized and approved by the governing board on Monday and presented to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology on Tuesday the 22nd. That committee heard it, and you have its recommendation in your binder.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair.
That's a 450, right?
Yeah. I seem to recall, unless I'm on the wrong one, that when we first heard this presentation, that any money, any expenses would be covered through savings. Is that correct? So are we being asked just to move the line item around?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, actually, the business case shows that the costs of the consolidation will be recovered from savings in a period of about 2.5 to 3 years.
Oh.
Then,
I didn't remember that part.
Yeah, the savings
of the original presentation.
Pay me now, save me later.
Right. There will be some upfront costs, costs associated with the consolidation, training of people, and the like. Again, the estimates now are 2.5 to 3 years of payback. The presentation, the indications are that you would have annual savings of between $8.5 million to $10 million in operating costs. And total transition costs vary between, I'm remembering a lot, $12 million to $15 or $17 million. So this is a request for other funds limitation that the department has some money, that some cash. It would be restored if it's approved. If the governor says go ahead, then they would expend some funds and they would be replaced supplanted with COPs ultimately for the infrastructure, the building. So the business case takes into consideration debt service costs, transition costs, and the like. This is, again, the recommendation it would be that approval with the understanding that the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division would not approve the allotment of the funds until, unless the governor says go.
Yeah.
Can I ask, Mr. Chair, what agencies will be involved in the consolidation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, for the record, my name is Bill Foster. I am the acting administrator of the Facilities Division, and with me here is the Chief Information Officer, and if you have some general questions about the business case and all the involvement, it might be best if I ask him to address those.
Which agencies we're going to consolidate?
There's 12 in the initial round.
Okay, then let's get to when we're done. And never mind the initial round. When we're finished, assuming we go forward with this, when we're finished, how many agencies will we have consolidated on this data piece?
Chairman Harper, Senator Dukes, for the record, my name is Don Foreman, State Chief Information Officer. There will be 12 of our largest data centers belonging to our 12 agencies will be consolidated if we go forward in an 18 to 24 month period. We will start with the three largest, DAS, DHS, and ODOT. That will produce the best, the most aggressive benefit stream from this project. And this particular project will then enable additional savings opportunities projects that we've identified, such as reducing the 70 email systems the state has down to one or two, things like that. So it has the business case is being vetted right now by several committees that advise the governing board, which consists of the 12 agency directors that are reviewing this, and we'll meet with the governor between the 1st of July and 15th of July and make a recommendation to proceed or not to proceed. So it'll be our 12 large data centers and networks. That represents well over 80% of the computing and networking capability of the state of Oregon.
And I think that's commendable, but how many state agencies do we have?
Well, we have, I actually don't know, it's probably
closer to 100.
100.
Okay. I think what's important is that this is really the first round. As Don has noted, we're talking about the bulk of data center network capacity in the state. That's all we're talking about for you today. As he noted, it obviously gets us to a place where we can start talking about the other 20% and whether it makes sense to bring them in.
What my interest was, and early on when we heard this, was what about the agencies that are under independent elected officials? And my understanding the first time around was, well, the governor doesn't have any control over them, so we're not going to go there. But I would think, I would like to believe some of those elected officials would be interested. And some of them are have offices and contacts and relationships that are far-flung enough. The Department of Education is one that occurs to me, that you would think that they could benefit from something like this. The other agency that I'm interested in is the Legislative Assembly. And we're not included in this, if I understand correctly. And I don't know about the rest of you, but our email system certainly could stand some revision.
I respond.
Yeah.
Chairman Harper has introduced and so already been mentioned. What we've done is we have started off in the initial project, which includes our 12 largest agencies. In that way, we think we produce the savings in the shortest possible time, and we also do the knowledge transfer into the state of the consolidation process, so we can then reduce the fees we pay to outside consultants that are assisting us in the consolidation. It also allows us to stabilize the data center. This is not a technical issue, but what happens is as you consolidate more and more workload into this data center, this new data center, it's impossible during that period to maintain a completely tested current disruption recovery plan, which means that the risk goes up as you go through the process. So we're stopping at 12 so we can stabilize the center, okay? Reduce our consulting costs by having achieved the knowledge transfer, and then we will proceed to go after the rest of the opportunities. Some of the things that are called data centers may not, in fact, they may be closets with computers in them, okay, because there are 32 data centers here. And let me give you an idea of what I'm talking about. The three largest data centers that the state of Oregon has, when added together, equals 60% of one medium-sized data center. The next nine largest data centers in the state of Oregon equals 16% of one medium-sized data center. All 12 added together equal about 75% of one medium-sized data center. All 32 facilities are less than one medium-sized data center. So we have a highly fragmented computing infrastructure, and we will approach all of the agencies for inclusion in the project. And the main criteria that we're going to be following is whether or not the consolidation of that agency dilutes or improves the business case, because we're doing this to try to both save money and maintain and improve the service level.
Chair, it may just be my feelings, but I certainly hope that the Legislative Assembly will get involved in this at some point. We run a completely separate system, and I don't understand it, why we run a completely separate system, but we do. And
Well,
your remote access representative, Butler, may be a whole lot better than my remote access, because you and I live in fairly
very
similar areas.
Just because you can take naps before.
So it seemed to me that we could benefit from getting in with the rest of the state.
It doesn't matter where that data comes from. If you don't have broadband, you're not going to benefit.
Well, it's not just
don't matter.
I finally gave up and got another system.
Well, what I did to my computer adds new meaning to the word reboot.
So anyway, I hope we're on your list somewhere.
May I make one other comment, Chairman Harper, Senator Dukes?
We're going to approve this.
Okay.
Possibly.
This also includes the consolidation of networks. There are 15 networks in the state, and we're going after about seven or eight of them as part of this consolidation. So we are going to be improving not just the data center, but the networking infrastructure, and that will eventually get to maybe addressing some of the concerns you have about remote access.
When we're finished with all of this, will Aeronautics be able to get a web page for less than $100,000? That's kind of what started some of this. That one just irritated me no end last session.
Any other discussion? Any objections to the recommendation, Ted? Okay, so ordered.
Thank you.
53. Let's see. That's obviously Representative Miller.
Yeah.
He's low on my list here.
Technology guru.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tina Edlund. I'm here on behalf of Bruce Goldberg, the administrator of our office, who can't be here today. He sends his apologies.
Is he afraid of us?
He's actually at a family reunion for his father's 85th birthday. So I'm here to request retroactive authorization for our office to apply for two federal grants to assist safety net healthcare providers in the state. Safety net healthcare providers deliver health care to the uninsured, to Medicaid clients, and to other vulnerable populations. The safety net includes hospitals, local departments of public health, and community health clinics, such as the Coastal Family Health Center in Astoria, the Sprague Valley Medical Center in Bly, the Waterfall Clinic in Coos Bay, and the Pine Eagle Clinic in Halfway. With the growing number of uninsured Oregonians and the reductions in Medicaid coverage, safety net providers in the state are facing formidable financial challenges, and the health of the safety net depends on the financial health of its providers. Safety net providers throughout Oregon and in rural areas in particular can be isolated from the resources that could help them assess and plan for financial crises, and they're often already overburdened with their main job, which is to supply direct patient care. Our first grant application seeks to work with rural safety net providers to improve an already developed financial analysis tool that will give them an early warning assessment using data that's readily available from their current balance sheets, and significantly increasing their ability to remain viable members of their community. This grant application, this first grant application, is for $150,000. The second grant application for $156,000 is a continuation of an existing grant originally funded in 2000. With these grant dollars, we'll be able to collect, assess, and share data detailing the capacity and access for safety net services at the local community level. Whereas the first grant focuses on the financial stability of rural safety net providers, this grant focuses on the state as a whole and looks at both supply and demand. One of the challenges of planning for the safety net is that the numbers are kind of hard to come by. We began a process this year working with clinic representatives, the Primary Care Association, the Office of Rural Health, and the Office of Health Systems Planning and others to identify what we already know and where the gaps are. We started the process of filling those gaps, but this grant would move us a long way along that road. Finally, our goal is to work with the local communities and to share this data at the local level so they can establish local benchmarks that will help them maximize local resources and enhance our ability to keep Oregon's fragile safety net viable. No state matching funds are required for either of these grants. Finally, if either or both are funded, we'll return to a future meeting of the Emergency Board to request federal funds limitation. I'm here to request your approval and to answer any questions you might have.
I support this. I think this is fine. But would you also take a look at Clask and I?
Mm-hmm.
They're right on the edge of losing the only health care.
No, Clask and I is your single nurse practitioner there.
Yeah.
No, it definitely is one of the clinics on the list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you get to the list before they go out of business.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Further discussion. I will keep my cynical comment to myself. I just hope we're able to do something real instead of just sit here and spin numbers. We need real stuff in our district. Reports are cool, but I need medicine and providers and stuff.
That would be our goal, too.
Maybe this will help. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the theory. Further discussion, questions, objection? So we'll go to the recommendation. The carrier is Messerly.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else, ladies and gentlemen? With that, we are adjourned.